web at newspress.com.
Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of Money Talk. I'm Neil Kreisel, and Diane Duver, and I are your hosts every week right here on AM 1290, repeated at 11, and on Saturdays at 6. We're brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending, whose highly trained and experienced team takes great pride in helping people with home financing, offering competitive rates and a wide array of loan programs. American Riviera Bank, smart banking for smart people in Santa Barbara, at Figueroa and Anacapa Streets, and in Montecito's Upper Village. And Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm in Santa Barbara, providing its clients with the personal care and attention of a small independent firm, coupled with the vast resources of a major financial institution.
Hi, Neil. How are you doing today?
Well, you know, every time I wake up in the morning now, I count how many days there are till election, and only one more week of that.
T minus eight you got going for you.
Well, you know, this is actually an important show because the voting location of our guest is Florida, and Florida may decide everything.
Yes, like they did in the Bush-Gore years, right?
Well, no, that was the Supreme Court. That wasn't the...
Oh, right.
That wasn't the voters. That was the Supreme Court. You forgot.
All right. Well, this isn't a show about politics. I know it's hard for you this close to the election, Neil, to, you know, keep it in check, but it is a show about finances. So we are thrilled to welcome to the show today Joe DeSanto from Florida, but he originally hails from my neck of the woods back in Rhode Island. So welcome, Joe, to the show. Thanks so much for being here. And we look forward to hearing from you.
Thanks for having me.
So the first article today is one that we had left over from last week. It is entitled, Look Who's Gambling on the Hot Stocks. And it's from the Wall Street Journal. And it begins by saying, when you point your finger at somebody, make sure to step away from the mirror. Professional money managers blaming individual investors and index funds for the phenomenal rise of speculative stocks should remember that. Index funds aren't the main buyers of these hot stocks. But who's driving them up? Well, it turns out it's professional stock pickers. On Robinhood app, used by millions of individual traders, Zoom was only number 49 of the widest owned stocks for last week. In fact, of the 25 stocks with market values above $10 billion that have the hottest return so far this year, only two are among the 25 most popular stocks on Robinhood. So who is the buyer of these stocks as opposed to what we hear in the press, that it's young, first-time investors? Well, it turns out it's institutions. And institutions have been chasing some of these hot stocks from the end of 2019 through September of this year. Institutions cumulatively bought 80 million shares, according to FactSet. That took institutional ownership from less than 52% to 55%. What is really interesting is that some of these institutions are value investors. So when asked why a value investor would buy a stock that's selling at infinitely times earnings or 1,000 times earnings, their answer is if they buy a little of it and it works, it is a big difference in their relative return.
And if you think about it, it's because value has been doing so poorly this year. You know, if you look at what's been going up in the S&P 500, it's the five big tech companies have been driving all the return for the S&P 500. And so these value companies are just trying not to be fired, I think, which is why they're adding in picks like Zoom.
Well, in Nicholas Taleb's Black Swan, he recommends what he calls the barbell strategy. And the barbell strategy is to invest 95% of your money in T-bills and 5% of your money in speculative stocks. And what a couple of the interviews in this article at the end talk about is exactly that, that they'll go out and they'll buy less than 0.5% of Zoom stock. If it doesn't work, so what? If it does work, it will make a big difference in their relative return. So in a way, the irony of it is some of these value funds, as you say, who haven't been doing well relative to the market are using this barbell approach to goose up their return. The next article is kind of related to that, and it's entitled Help, The Pandemic Turned My Parents into Day Traders. And the article is written by a Wall Street Journal writer who went home for a visit and found her mother and father trading stocks, literally day trading stocks. And, you know, part of it, she said, it was the pandemic. They just got bored. But part of it is they got caught up in the whole notion that when, of course, they started it in March when the market hit the bottom. But they got caught up in this whole idea that they could look at a stock and play it, as they said, and they would make money, and it became incredible fun. And, you know, this is, to me, even worse than the Robin Hood concept that some of the people were blaming on the stock market. When people are looking at stocks, and the article talks about this, not for what they do, but for how their price has been, then you get just the opposite of Warren Buffett investing. You get investing based upon stock movement rather than fundamental changes, which I think is really very dangerous.
Well, if you think about it, what we're seeing right now during this time is people are investing. If they started investing in March, they're much like the end of the 1999, the dot-com bubble, where people are just, you know, can't fathom losing money again. And that's always a dangerous time when individual investors aren't looking at companies for their long-term growth perspectives, but rather just how far they've come off the bottom in March. And, you know, this V-shaped recovery that we've enjoyed is a recovery that normally you don't see in 3 months, you see in 3 years. And so, you know, it could be very dangerous for those investors.
The next article is a subject that I brought up last week, and I did not get favorable reviews when I talked about the lack of women's confidence in investing. And this one sort of takes that same position. And it's from the New York Times this weekend, and it is entitled, Why Wealthy Millennial Women Tend to Defer to Husbands on Investing. And a study that was published by UBS in June underscored that Most educated and high achieving millennial women were not as involved in their husbands in long-term financial decision-making. In fact, millennial women, part of a generation thought to have pushed for open-mindedness about gender roles, exhibited less independence than boomer women did. Among millennial women living with male partners, 54% said they deferred to their partners for long-term financial planning rather than share that responsibility or take the lead themselves. The primary reason these women gave was their belief that their husbands knew better than they did. Do you agree with that, Diane?
Well, let's just say that's not the same way as it is in my house. However, I think it starts from an early age. When you start looking at the research of elementary school and math and how that all plays out, boys think they're better at math than girls do because they grasp the concept more quickly based upon their early brain development. And consequently, by the time children are in third grade, they already have a preset notion of things that they're good at and things that they're not good at. And that carries through them for the rest of their life. And so if they think that they're not good at math when they're 6 years old, then when they're 26 years old or 36 years old, they're going to defer to their male counterpart who normally, if we're talking about stereotypes, men tend to show more strength and bravado. Whether or not they truly understand it is a different question than their female counterparts. And so I think it's an educational system lapse for Americans more than the actual fact that women aren't, I think it's more women aren't interested because they've been told that that's not where they excel.
The final article we have time for today, I picked because it's just got a funny title. It's called The Man Who Returned $10 Billion. Our recent performance sucks, says Ted Aronson, who's closing his $10 billion fund. And basically, his fund was a value fund, and he just couldn't succeed at relative performance. And he felt that While he still believes in the whole concept, he felt it was really unfair to hold people's money when, in fact, he couldn't outperform, which is so interesting that somebody with a $10 million hedge fund, which you don't really see usually because they're getting 2% no matter what happens, for them to give that up for a lack of relative performance. And he said it's probably the wrong time. He said it's probably going to turn around, but he just doesn't want to play anymore. So kudos to him for giving up a great deal of income because he wasn't outperforming the market. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
It's a fact. Successful wealth management is built on strategies that focus on the big picture, take a long-term view, and establish deep and valued relationships. Hello, I'm Diane Duva, founding partner at Arlington Financial Advisors, Santa Barbara's trusted family guide, empowering you to make more informed and confident decisions. At Arlington Financial Advisors, we bring order and balance to your financial life by monitoring and managing risk so you can focus on your work, family, and enjoying the moment. We are a fully independent firm offering strategic financial planning, estate and tax planning, and private money management. Our plans and portfolios are handcrafted using a rigorous and disciplined approach, supported by a consistent yet highly personalized client experience. Our clients look to Arlington Financial Advisors as a home away from home, a comfortable place to protect what they've accomplished while they prepare for what comes next. Please visit arlingtonfinancialadvisors.com or call me, Diane Duva, at 805-699-7300.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Cornerstone Home Lending since 1988, a mortgage banker and direct lender that believes in providing in-depth loan consulting to its customers in a personalized and honest manner.
And we can be reached for any questions at, you could either email us at moneytalk1290@gmail.com, or you could give us a call at the radio station at 805-564-1290. And if you're just joining us, we have the pleasure of having Joe DeSanto, who's the owner of Play Louder, with us today. Joe, thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So Joe, you've done so many things, and we'll get into that, but what made you become interested in money?
What made me become interested in money? Well, it's funny, you were talking about, I didn't know that factoid about boys' brain development allowing them to apparently pick up math a little sooner than girls. That was interesting to learn. But I was always good at math, so I think that maybe has something to do with it, but I think really actually had to do when I was a kid, my parents split up. And prior to that, you know, my dad owned a business, so, you know, money wasn't a concern. And then after they split up, it was a bit of a dicey split up, I guess you would say. So we were kind of on our own, and at least for a while. And my mom, you know, she was born in the 40s, so she quit college to start a family. She never really worked. And all of a sudden, my mom was kind of now in control of the money that we had from the divorce. And it wasn't a ton. And money just started to become a big stress in our lives. And for what, you know, my mom, I guess, didn't exactly have a lot of people to talk to about it. And I was a little bit mature for my age, so I sort of got into the conversation about money with her early on. And really just came to the understanding that, you know, money was burning and she didn't really have the income potential anymore to keep up with our spending. So slowly our money just depleted and it just caused more and more problems. And I started to pick up on how serious of an issue that is, essentially. And I kind of say sometimes, if you don't deal with your money will definitely deal with you. So I just got into it. I got a job early on and I liked the idea of saving money. I, for some reason, had an interest in the stock market and investing. That seemed kind of interesting to me. And it just kind of went from there. And then eventually, when I was in college, you know, I paid for my own college. So I had a bunch of student loans and I also picked up a lot of the tab with credit cards. So by the end of college, between loans and credit cards, I owed like $45,000. And I was heading out on my work journey. And I was like, wow, I really got to start keeping track of this, I think. You know, I'm going to have to keep an eye on this. So I started a little spending journal. And I would write down every day what I would spend money on. And, you know, very quickly you realize, you know, especially at that age, you're outspending what you're making. And but I was like, you know what, that's okay. It's sad news, but I got to keep up with this. And but eventually I was like, God, this is really kind of an archaic process. I'm writing this down in a book and I'm having to like add it up with a calculator. It's just very time consuming. So like, there's got to be like a computer program for this. And there was, it was Quicken. And I started using Quicken at a young age, you know, pretty much the end of college. And I kind of, in a sense, taught myself accounting almost just by using Quicken on my own. And I took, you know, the experience of using Quicken, simple as it is, and used that to manage the money for my businesses. And as I began to start businesses, I did all the money management. I did all the bookkeeping at first. I cut all the checks. I, you know, looked at our money. I saw how we were doing. Like it was something that I always did on the weekends because I felt like I really wanted to be in close contact with how things were going. And I think that really just kind of, you know, came from my young, I guess, concerns over money. And I wanted to make sure I was sort of in control of it, you know?
Absolutely. And so you then moved out to Los Angeles, correct? And you became involved in TV production. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, actually, I was in post-production mainly. Later in our business ownership, we actually started a production company and then produced some documentaries and a TV show. But it all started with post-production, which for, you know, your listeners who are not familiar with that, whenever you're making something, would be a movie or a TV show or even a television commercial, you start out with production. Well, there's an idea, and then you go shoot it, you know, the production process. You get the material in camera. And then at the end of that, which usually takes, you know, anywhere from a day to a week, that material goes over to the post-production company. And that's where they edit it together and, you know, do a whole bunch of other processes, including visual effects or graphic design or audio editing and sound design and audio mastering. So we would take it from shot material and then deliver a tape, to, you know, to the network or wherever it was going, essentially. Nowadays, you deliver a file, but.
So now how did you get involved in post-production and start that company?
Yeah, so I actually went to New York after school. I went to school in Massachusetts, your hometown.
My home state.
And then I went to New York. I was actually a photography major in college. And I was planning on doing photography and kind of being a photographer's assistant or whatever that road was going to, however that road was going to unfold. And then a family friend said, hey, I know, you know, a family friend has some kind of like company that does graphics. I don't exactly know what it is, but if you want to go over there, you know, I'll set you up with a meeting. So I was like, yeah, please, I'll go over there. And I walk into this place and it was a post-production company and post-production and production, but the industry is really interesting. I mean, it's fun work, but the places, particularly post-production studios, they're very nice. You know, they're like going into like a beautiful home or something, because they're designed to have clients in and, you know, kind of put on a good show and all that sort of stuff. So I walked into this place and I was like, wow, this place is amazing. Like, I want to work at this place. So I managed to get a job there. And that's how I got into the business. And I kind of worked my way up from essentially the shipping room, you know, the equivalent of the mail room or whatever.
Right. So it's the William Morris way of getting your first job.
Exactly.
Everybody starts in the mail room.
Yeah. We were in the tape library and shipping room. Tapes came in, tapes went out, that sort of stuff. And just kind of worked my way up. And then I moved out to LA a couple of years later. I was kind of getting tired of New York, and I just kept plugging away in the business, but I always knew I wanted to start a business. And I think it's because, you know, my dad owned a business, and that really makes a big difference, I think, when your family kind of has a business, because, you know, it seems like something that's attainable. You know, it's not a big deal. You're like, I could own a business. So I really just wanted to do that at some point, and I kind of just kept my eye on it. And over the course of my working in post-production in Los Angeles, I met my partners, and eventually we took the leap and started a company. And it was tough at first, but we did it pretty young. I was 30, I think, when we started. Yeah, I was 30 when we started the company, so I didn't have kids yet, so that was good. It made it a little safer. I wasn't too worried about going totally bust, but it worked out. And in the 14 years that I was an owner of the company, we grew from strictly post-production, but eventually we decided to branch out, because a lot of people, even who do post-production, you know, they have dreams of making films or making documentaries or, you know, making their own content. And we did as well. At that point, we were doing mostly like work for hire for commercials, largely, some TV, some music videos. And we set out to produce a documentary. And we did that. It was called Transcendent Man. It was about the life and ideas of a guy named Ray Kurzweil. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him, but it went well, premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival. And that kind of was our foray into doing our own production. And so we did a few more documentaries. And then, you know, our kind of big claim to fame was the last production project we did called Sonic Highways for HBO. And that, I don't know if any of you seen that or seen some of those episodes, but it's a docu-series about the Foo Fighters, making of the Foo Fighters like 28th anniversary album, which is also called Sonic Highways. So
nice.
Yeah, that was a really great experience.
So what made you transition from what seems to be an exciting, you know, business ownership, production, post-production? You received, you know, an Emmy for the HBO series Sonic mm-hmm. Highway. What made you at that point decide to want to take another leap and make a profession change?
Yeah, so that's kind of crazy. And it wasn't that I didn't enjoy my work, because I really did. It was great. And actually, my wife's an editor, and we worked together at our company. She edited Sonic Highways or one of the episodes. But we had a child, and we quickly learned that children take up a lot of your time. And
no.
Yeah, like I just, honestly, I know it sounds stupid, but I couldn't believe how much time it was. Like, I was like, wow, you really have to keep your eye on this thing like 24/7. Like, you can't not have eyes on it. That's like kind of a, you know, it's a big deal. You're like, it's either your eyes or you're paying someone to watch the baby. You know, and as you can imagine, entertainment industry is a long hours gig. So it just became really hard to kind of balance it all for us. I mean, plenty of people do it. We had a nanny and it was fine. But just working the long hours, like, just kind of wasn't as fun anymore. It was a lot of all this rushing around. And somewhere along the line, we were like, you know, like, maybe we should try to work less and hang out with this kid more, you know, like really like focus on this child that we decided to have. And that seed just got planted. I don't know how, between my wife and I, we were just kind of at night, but after we got the kid to bed, we'd sort of talk about this. And then we just talked about it enough where we were like, well, we keep talking about this. Maybe we should try to do something different.
And we'll be right back with what happened when that seed was planted. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Jeff Devine from American Riviera Bank. All of our customers were once just like you, stuck with a bank that kept charging more for less. But when they finally made the decision to change banks, American Riviera Bank made the move easy with mobile deposit, online banking, free use of every ATM in the country, and a level of customer service that other banks dream of. Come in and make the move today in our downtown Santa Barbara or Montecito Upper Village branches. American Riviera Bank, smart banking for smart people.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
Your daughter just had her first breakup. Do you A, put yourself in her shoes?
How could he do this to you? And for Sheila, she has split ends.
B, console her.
Oh, sweetie, this is going to happen a lot. 4, maybe 5 more times before you get married.
C, take charge.
Got to get this all straightened out. Give him a little talking to man, mano a mano. Hey, Steve, it's now a good time? No? Okay, no problem. Bye.
Or D, help her find a new boyfriend.
I know a great place to meet boys. The internet. Nice, single boys. Never mind. How about some ice cream?
As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
Hey, this is Ellen DeGeneres. We all have a vital role to play in helping California communities, firefighters, and first responders battling wildfires throughout the state. In this time of crisis, the entertainment community unites in support of those keeping us safe. Join us at musicforrelief.org/fire and give to provide firefighters with the critical equipment they need to protect our neighborhoods. That's musicforrelief.org/fire. Thanks.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
And so, Joe, before the break, you were telling us about what really made your decision to you know, get out of your business that you had put your blood, sweat, and tears into and take a leap of faith and do something else. So your son, he was about 3, and you and your wife decided to, you know, call it quits in Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah. As I was saying, the seed got planted to maybe try something different. And we just decided to execute on it. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, didn't happen in a day. It probably took a year and a half of sort of planning. Because, you know, when you have a lot going on, you have to sort of extricate yourself from all this stuff, like, you know, legally and just like emotionally. But luckily my partners are awesome guys. We're like, you know, best friends basically. And they were very supportive. So they, you know, we kind of laid out, figured out how to slowly, you know, phase me out. But what was really cool of them was, you know, I always managed the money. Like I said, that was my thing. And it worked out. So none of them really, you know, bothered too much. We would have our meetings and all that stuff. It's kind of funny. You were talking about earlier the relationship and the man or the woman, and, you know, kind of one person does the finances. It's very much like that in business, too. I think of business partnerships very much like marriages, sometimes just with more than 2 people. And I was the money person of the marriage, the business marriage, and everybody, you know, had confidence in my abilities. And so they just kind of did their thing. You know, everyone kind of did the thing that they were best at. But being I had, you know, was really the person who had their head in that for so long, they said, hey, if you want, you know, what if we just like pay you to stay on like consulting style and just keep managing the money, you know, just make sure that we stay on track and do what you've been doing. And, you know, and I was like, yeah, that'd be great. Cause to be honest with you, we didn't really have that much of a plan like what we were going to do work-wise. I mean, I had saved a lot of money and basically being, you know, frugal and sort of financially prudent. and also making pretty decent money. You know, we had a pretty good nest egg built up and we had some runway, and I figured, you know, we'll see what happens. I kind of had also this funny notion of doing this educational blog, which is what Play Louder is. And, but anyway, yeah, they offered to keep me on to do that. And that was great. And then slowly, you know, other people I knew that owned businesses in LA were like, hey, are you doing that now? You know, would you do that for us? Because we really need someone to manage our money. You know, it's like, if just like in marriages, you know, it's really handy when one of the couple has an interest, a genuine interest in finances. And, you know, from my experience, I don't know that that necessarily would be the woman versus the man or not. It sounds like there's some stats and reasons why maybe it leans towards the guy. I don't know, but it doesn't matter who it is. I think every marriage or family benefits from having someone genuinely interested in finance and keeping an eye on it. Now, that's not always the case, you know, and many business partnerships don't have that person. And
hey, so Joe, when you say manage the money, are you talking about managing cash flow and daily cash activity of a company? Or are you talking about investing money that the company has, or both?
It's a little bit of both. It's first and foremost, actually just managing the cash flow, literally doing the bookkeeping. I mean, you get to a point at some point where you maybe have a bookkeeper as well, but it's looking at how much money you're making, what you're spending money on, looking at your quality revenue streams, just figuring out, really paying attention to what's happening. Because even if you make a lot of money in one particular area, if that area costs you a lot of money, then, you know, maybe you're not making as much money with that as you think you are. You have to always be looking at those things. But then also you do want to say, invest whatever you can, whether that be into new ideas, into new employees that maybe you're going to bring new knowledge into your business. Or in our case, we invested in real estate. So we took a lot of our, what would have been profits or maybe gone into our bank accounts. And we decided to, one, buy the buildings that we had the business in. So we bought two buildings to house our businesses over the years. And that worked out really well. We reinvested in the company in the content sense. Like, we paid for that original documentary that we did that was very successful and led to a whole new production line of work for us. So it is kind of figuring out how much money you're making and what you have, but then figuring out ways to reinvest that. But it's not necessarily investing it like in stocks or whatever. Though with individuals, I don't particularly like tell them what to do, but I do give like general guidance, you know, on investing for retirement and that sort of stuff.
So that's how you got started as a fractional CFO for various businesses. So would you say your niche in that arena would be more of that Hollywood production companies, or does it run the gamut in terms of the type of company? It's, you know, it's the numbers that's attracted to you, that you're attracted to.
Yeah, I think that I bring more value to a company that is media oriented. It doesn't have to be entertainment, but any kind of media creation, whether that be, you know, audio, even, you know, podcasting or television commercials or entertainment or whatever. I just have a lot of contacts in that space, so I can bring a little bit more value in that sense. But, you know, good business sense and understanding applies to any business. And now I have some clients that are outside of entertainment and outside of Los Angeles. I have a client in Ohio and another one in Austin. They're media related companies though, but not necessarily entertainment based. But small businesses, I think too, are kind of more my niche. That's what I've been doing. Therapy got up to about 30 employees. So when I say small, somewhere like, you know, 5 to 50 employees. Bring good value.
Which really, when you think about the revenues of companies about that size, they really most can't afford to have a in-house full-time CFO to manage these things for them. So that's when someone like yourself comes in.
Yeah.
So it sounds like Play Louder really is your passion, this educational blog that you put together. So tell us a little bit about it and what you hope to accomplish with it.
Yeah. So the reason I decided to do this was Partly because over the years of owning a business, we hired a lot of young people, and I had probably half a dozen assistants kind of cycle through that position with me and move on to either other positions in our company or onto other positions outside our company. And I would work, and we would work in an open workspace area. I didn't have my own office. I preferred to like work with everybody in the same room. But they would hear me like working on real estate and like, you know, doing different things. And I would get a lot of questions, you know, from our young employees. Well, like, what should I do? Like, when should I buy a house? Why should I do this? What should I invest in? You know, you seem like you know what's going on. And so I kind of ended up in this just, you know, like a little bit of a mentor role, not just for our work, but just like life advice in general. And oftentimes people would say to me, you know, you should teach a class. You should go to the community college or whatever and teach people how to do personal finances because no one knows how to do that stuff. And I was like, yeah, someday I'll go teach a class at the community college. But I did think that was a good idea. Like I thought it would be fun. But, you know, cut to 2020, an easy way to do that is to do it online now. You know, you can teach, not only just have information on a blog, but you can actually have courses, which I also have on my blog. So, and what I find is companies obviously have enough of a budget to hire someone, you know, like me in a part-time capacity, but individuals aren't necessarily going to spend hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars a month on like a personal money manager. Some will if they have enough. And I do manage the personal finances of some of the owners of the companies that I work with. But I wanted to be able to bring a lot of this information to people, individuals who are in, you know, want to learn and, you know, figure it all out, but obviously aren't going to spend that kind of money on a monthly basis. So I put the site together and I just been putting up all my knowledge. You know, it's taken me a long time. Writing actually, you know, meaningful quality content on a blog actually takes a lot of time, as it turns out. If you go online and look up blogging, they sort of make it sound easy, but it's not.
So we're going to take a break. Yeah. We're going to spend the next 2 minutes figuring out how to do a blog. You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back.
The Foundation for Santa Barbara City College is a nonprofit organization which supports our own Santa Barbara City College. The Foundation for Santa Barbara City College, or SBCC, funds scholarships, childcare, book grants, and other programs. Without these, many students simply would not be able to attend college. There is an amazing range of academic and vocational studies offered at City College which encourage students to find their passion and their talents. As a donor to the foundation, you have the power to change lives. Please help our community college by donating to the Foundation for SBCC. Call 730-4401 or visit us at sbccfoundation.org to find out how you can help. That's 730-4401 or sbccfoundation.org.
Dad? Over. Whoa.
The moment my son saw a redwood tree.
It's huge!
Is the moment I knew that for him.
You can't even see the top of that thing.
Even the sky has no limit.
There are some moments only the forest can inspire. Find yours at discovertheforest.org. Learn about forests near you and discover cool things to do when you go, like hiking, biking, fishing, or camping. Or do your own thing when you get there with family and friends. Your moment is out there. Find it at discovertheforest.org. That's discovertheforest.org.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Welcome back
to Money Talk, brought to you by American Riviera Bank, making your life easier with cutting-edge technology, mobile deposits, free use of every ATM machine in the country, and a level of service other banks can only dream about.
So, Joe, tell us about how your business has fared, both the fractional CFO business as well as the blogging business, during these unprecedented times in 2020.
Sure. Well, I have to say, I guess with the fractional CFOing, it's been good because my clients really have needed someone to help navigate the waters, and functionally just needed someone to fill out all the applications for PPP money and now doing the PPP forgiveness stuff and all that sort of thing. So I came in real handy, I guess I would say. And I think most of our clients were pretty grateful. Luckily, they've been faring okay, and you know, can still essentially pay me to do the job. So far, so good for us.
Can I ask you about the PPP loan forgiveness? How is that working, and how have you seen it working for our listeners out there who have applied? Yes, they have to talk to their bank in order to get the loan forgiveness, but have you seen any pitfalls that would be helpful for them to avoid if possible?
Sure. Well, I would say that the kinks in the system are, you know, are much fewer now. That first round, we were like lined up as quickly as possible, especially Therapy Mail Company, which is the bigger of the clients of mine. And we make a Bank of America. So we're like thinking, okay, Bank of America's probably got a good SBA relationship, this, that, and the other. And it was just like a nightmare. Like, I mean, everybody just totally failed. The big banks in particular just totally failed on servicing so many clients because it's just clunky, you know? And it's like, it ended up—
Yeah, the community banks definitely did a much better job at facilitating with the process with their clients and having their clientele— Yes. —get the loans as well as have happy clients at the end of it.
In a way, we thought everyone was competing for the same pool of money. It turned out they weren't. The community banks actually had their own divvied up share, and they only had 1,000 applications they were processing instead of 180,000. In the end, we didn't even get money in round one, so we were kind of panicked there for a second. We ended up doing well in round two, and I went to a smaller bank, actually. I applied like five times for therapy to five different banks just to be safe, and we ended up getting it from a smaller bank. But then a lot of the other clients, I did one application through PayPal, and they were just super dialed in. That process was just so easy and fast, I couldn't believe it. And you know, they have a few different actual funders that you end up potentially getting the money from, but they just have a dialed in process. And I did a couple applications kind of later in round two, and we got funded, you know, within like a week, which was—
So would you advise your clients to have a dual relationship with a big bank as well as a smaller bank for this particular experience?
Well, you know, I don't know that this experience would indicate that a smaller bank on the whole is, you know, all that necessary or worthwhile. I mean, I have to admit, my feelings over the years with smaller banks, as much as I like the community kind of bank, you know, concept, they don't have the funds to usually have really good online banking stuff and, you know, a variety of things. So, but they also, they're really good on lending, much more so than the big banks. So it's funny, I do my banking at Bank of America, but most of the loans I would get, even for the real estate and bigger loans and big credit lines, I would end up getting through, you know, regional banks like City National Bank or Bank of the West or something like that. So I guess, you know, yes, now that I'm saying all that, yes, it is good to have a relationship with both. It's kind of hard though. That's the thing. You know, they want your average deposit business, and it's like, how many bank accounts can you have, you know? But yeah, if you wanted to keep things more flexible, maybe you would have a bank account at a smaller bank, send some of your deposits over there, pay some of your bills out of there on a monthly basis. And that will actually give you a little bit of edge, you know, when it comes to lending issues, you know, down the road.
So I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, you know, I spent my whole life in finance, and if somebody said to me, I could go to Hollywood and make movies, I'd say, I'll do it in a minute because I can't think of anything more boring than finance. So you gave up a career in making documentaries, making features in order to get involved in the PPE requests of some of your clients. I mean, that really sounds nuts.
Yeah, I guess it does when you put it that way. Thanks a lot, Neil. Appreciate it.
Neil's now going to give you the number to your shrink.
No, but I think you're just sour that you never went to Hollywood to make your movie, Neil. That's what I'm hearing.
No, but I'm saying just the opposite. I think you died. You know, you did great. You went to Hollywood. You became a success, and now you want to get involved in bookkeeping. I mean, it just seems so different.
Well, it is funny. Like, it's just something honestly, I'm a little OCD, to be honest with you. I'm sort of a numbers person. But I was an art major in college. So I'm like numbers and art. But I find there's something about doing math that's like very therapeutic to me. I like doing stuff that has concrete, like answers.
You know? I was going to say, that's the number one question when people say, answer when people say that.
And you know, the funny thing is like, after 20 years of us doing kind of entertainment related stuff, it's like, it was boiling down to where like, I didn't feel like dealing with clients anymore. I didn't feel like managing the project anymore. I kind of didn't feel like doing it anymore, but I like sitting in front of my computer and looking at like our accounting all the time. And I really, honestly, one day I thought to myself, you know, it would be funny, I know, but I wouldn't be surprised if at some point I end up just being like a CFO type consultant for small businesses. That was well before that idea kind of rolled through my head one day, well before I decided to leave. So, you know, you can get tired of anything, Neil.
I have some advice for you. Watch out for Common Core math.
Okay.
It will rock your world, and the answer is right. So when your son gets a little older, you'll be like, what?
Yeah.
Don't help him. That's what my advice is. Delegate that to your wife.
Okay.
You're listening to Money Talk on AM 1290 KZSB, and we'll be right back with our final segment.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jeff Devine from American Riviera Bank. All of our customers were once just like you, stuck with a bank that kept charging more for less. But when they finally made the decision to change banks, American Riviera Bank made the move easy with mobile deposit, online banking, free use of every ATM in the country, and a level of customer service that other banks dream of. Come in and make the move today in our downtown Santa Barbara or Montecito Upper Village branches. American Riviera Bank, smart banking for smart people.
For prospective homebuyers, one of the most important steps of the loan process is getting clear and honest information from someone who will speak plainly and truthfully about loan programs and options.
I'm Kelly Marsh, Vice President, California, of Cornerstone Home Lending, where our highly skilled and experienced team takes great pride in helping clients obtain home financing with honest, knowledgeable, fast, friendly, and efficient service. As a Santa Barbara native who has spent the past 20 years in the mortgage industry and has closed over 4,000 loans, I'd appreciate the opportunity to earn your business and invite you to visit thekellymarshteam.com or call my office at 805-563-1100 to learn more about how Cornerstone Home Lending can help you determine the best way to manage mortgage debt to achieve a more stable financial future.
Licensed by the Department of Business Oversight under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. California Residential Mortgage Lending Act license number 41DB072220. California Financial Lending Law license number 60DB072528. Loan originator NMLS number 245822. Not a commitment to loan. Equal housing opportunity.
Okay, forest animals. Kids are coming to the forest, and it's up to us to make their visit a good one. Sparrow, have you practiced the most popular bird songs for the year?
Of course.
Catchy. I like it. River, how's the temperature?
It's a refreshing 52 degrees, man.
I love it. Turtle.
He's not here yet, man.
He's late every morning. Okay. Squirrel.
The forest has been preparing just for you. To learn more about cool things to do in the forest, visit discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Money Talk, brought to you by Arlington Financial Advisors, a leading wealth management firm founded on providing thoughtful, objective, and comprehensive financial guidance for families and entities who are seeking long-term financial confidence.
So, Joe, on the break, we were talking about the concept of fire. Mm-hmm. So can you explain that for our listeners? Because I do think it's interesting.
Yeah, fire is a newfangled concept by the millennials, which I'm not, I'm a Gen Xer. It stands for financial independence, retire early. And it's become pretty big, but it's really, I guess, driven initially by these super frugal millennials that make good money, you know, at their job. A lot of them are software developers and this, that, and the other. So they make decent money, but they don't spend a lot of money. They literally live off as little as they possibly can and invest their money, you know, in the stock market and real estate or whatever, with the goal of reaching financial independence. And, you know, traditional retirement is essentially financial independence. But in their mind, financial independence is they don't have to work for money anymore. They can work because they want to if they enjoy it, but they don't need to work to live their life. So there's a whole movement of people out there trying to reach financial independence, and they all have what they call their FIRE number in mind. You know, that's kind of one of the things they ask you, their other ask each other, what's your FIRE number? Like, what number are you trying to get to before you can, you know, quit the regular life and go financial independent? So I call myself sort of semi-retired, you know, in FIRE terms, because now there's a whole bunch of different FIRE terms. There's fat FIRE, there's, you know, semi-FIRE, there's this, that, and the other. But so I, you know, don't need to make a full-time income. I work part-time doing my consulting and make, you know, other money from real estate and other, you know, passive income streams, you might say. So there's just a whole crazy movement in and around this FIRE concept. And it brings in, you know, obviously investing, real estate's a big component because people are trying to create, you know, streams of income that they can live off of. It's essentially everything we've been working, you know, you're always working towards in terms of retirement, but essentially getting there sooner if you can. I don't know how people live off $30,000 a year. I mean, I'm a pretty financially prudent person. I couldn't do it, but I guess I go for convenience over insane frugality.
Well, you know, to each his own, I suppose, yeah. But definitely, that day when people are working because they want to, not because they have to, is a freeing moment for people. And regardless of whether or not they're part of this FIRE movement or just part of the normal, you know, trying to make prudent financial decisions. So, you know, I just want to say, Joe, thank you so much for being here with us today and sharing your experience. It's definitely been one that we haven't heard very much of. But before we let you go, I just wanted to ask you if you have a quick piece of advice on real estate and creating that passive income.
Okay, my piece of advice on real estate, if there are people out there hunting for real estate, particularly like out-of-state real estate where you can't manage it yourself and you're not able to find the deals yourself, you know, it's commonly referred to as turnkey real estate, you got to do better than the 1% rule. You got to do better than that because the expenses of turnkey real estate are going to be way, way higher than any turnkey provider is going to tell you. So you probably want to be doing 1.2% on that ratio of monthly rent versus purchase price. That's my little
advice. And we only have 30 seconds left. So just tell everyone how to get to Play Ladder if they're interested in joining your courses and your blog.
PlayLadder.com. It's work smarter, plan better, play louder. And okay. I have all sorts of knowledge there and courses.
Okay, thank you. Play Ladder it is. Thank you for being here, Joe. Thank you all for listening. You've been listening to Money Talk, and we'll see you all next week. It's